Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. I'm always looking to help the Next Level Soul audience take their soul to the next level. And I've been able to partner with Mind Valley to present you guys with a ton of free masterclasses between 60 and 90 minutes covering mind, body, soul, relationships, and conscious entrepreneurship. Some of these masterclasses are taught by spiritual masters, relationship experts, best-selling authors, legends in the personal growth and spirituality space, and so much more. So if you want to sign up for any of our free mind, body, and soul masterclasses, just head over to nextlevelsoul.com/free. Have you ever wondered if there is life after death? I know we've had a few near-death experiencers on the show, but today we have Dr. Bruce Grayson, MD. And he wrote the book, After a Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. He has spent the last 27 years working on that question, trying to answer it for us. His book challenges everyday ideas about our minds, our brain, and it offers key insights on how we begin to live more meaningful and fulfilling lives. Let's dive in. I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Bruce Grayson. How are you doing, Dr. Grayson?
Great, Alex. Thanks so much for having me here.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I am fascinated to talk to you today because you have a very unique perspective on near-death experiences. I've had other doctors on the show, Dr. Raymond Moody, who I know you know, and Dr. Eden Alexander. But the way you've looked at it is very interesting. So first and foremost, what was your first experience with near-death experiences? What made you go down this not traditional road, especially when you started it out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to start with, I was raised in a scientific, materialistic household. My father was a chemist, and I was raised in that environment that, you know, what you see is what you get. There's no non-physical world. And when you die, that's the end. That's just the way it is. So I went through college and medical school with that mindset that the physical world is all there is, and science is the way to answer all our questions. And then when I started my psychiatric training, shortly after I started, I was confronted by a patient who was unconscious when I tried to talk with her. And when I saw her the next day, when she had woken up, she told me about my visiting her in the hospital and described things she couldn't possibly have seen or heard because she was unconscious. And that just made no sense to me at all. So I kind of didn't know what to do with it. I just sort of said, oh, that's weird, and left it at that. Figured someone's playing a trick on me or something. But I started hearing other patients talking about the same thing, and I tended to dismiss them since they were psychiatric patients. And then about 4 or 5 years later, one of my colleagues at University of Virginia, Raymond Moody, who you've also interviewed here, published a book called Life After Life, in which he gave us the term near-death experience and described what they were. And that was the first indication I had that this is a real phenomenon. It's not just a few crazy patients telling stories. This is happening to perfectly sane people all over the world. But being a scientist, I needed to understand this. And I figured you don't run away from things you can't understand. That's not science. You run towards them. So I started collecting other cases and see whether I could figure out what's going on here. And I collected thousands of cases. And here I am 50 years later, still trying to understand them.
Still trying to figure it. It's not an easy equation.
It's not. And there are good reasons for that too. Yeah.
Exactly. So, from a medical perspective, what is the science behind a near-death experience?
Alex, I wish we had some. There have been lots of theories proposed to explain near-death experiences, both psychological in terms of wishful thinking and expectations, and physiological explanations like lack of oxygen to the brain or drugs given to patients. And the data we've been able to collect to test these hypotheses have all disproven them. It's not expectation. People have near-death experiences that directly contradict what they're expecting to happen. And so on and so forth. We've collected data about physiological things going on at the time of the near-death event. It turns out that people who have near-death experiences or NDEs actually have better oxygen supply than people who don't have NDEs. So lack of oxygen isn't causing these. And likewise, people who are given drugs as they're approaching death tend to have fewer near-death experiences than people who aren't given drugs. So none of the explanations that science has come up with have been able to explain what's going on here.
And now those are, and those examples are people who die and come back.
Right, right.
Because not everybody who dies and comes back has a near-death experience.
Right. And the ones who don't come back don't tell us about their experience.
Obviously.
Yeah. About 10 to 20% of people whose hearts stop will talk about a near-death experience later on.
So it's not widely. It's not like everybody who dies and comes back or has a heart attack has a near-death experience. It's a good percentage, though. That's a pretty decent size.
It is. It's not negligible by any means.
Now, there's a chapter in your book that's called "The Mind Is Not the Brain." Can you dig into that a little bit? Because we're going to get into the waters of consciousness and awareness and stuff.
Well, let's start with what we're talking about. The mind is that part of us that thinks and feels and perceives and has desires and urges and so forth. The brain is this 3 pounds of material inside our skulls that's mostly nerve cells and cells called glial cells that support the nerve cells. And the question is, what does one have to do with the other? And I was taught in medical school that the brain creates the mind. All our thoughts and feelings are created by these nerve cells. And that seems to work in everyday life. For example, when you get drunk, you don't think very well. Or when you get hit on the head, that affects your thinking. But in extreme circumstances, like near-death experiences, the brain seems to be shutting down. And yet people report that their thinking was clearer and faster than ever. Their perceptions were sharper than ever. And that shouldn't happen if the brain is shutting down. And there are other examples besides near-death experiences in which we see this dissociation between the brain and the mind. For example, with psychedelic drugs, we used to think that the way these drugs work is by stimulating the brain to hallucinate. But neuroimaging studies in the last 10, 15 years have shown repeatedly that the more elaborate mystical experiences people have with psychedelic drugs are associated with a decrease in brain activity, not an increase. So again, it appears that when the brain is shutting down, consciousness seems to flower. And we don't have any explanation for why that should be in terms of medical. Yeah.
So that there's a case to be made for meditation in that way too, because heavy meditators who quiet their minds have, some of them have mystical experiences. They definitely talk about different avenues of spirituality that should be associated with more brain activity. But you're saying that, because I just thought about that. You're right. Like the yogis, you know, the spiritual masters who go down and I've seen some monks, some Tibetan monks that they've attached and done scans to when they're meditating, their brain just starts to go down, but yet they are able to have more stuff going on. It's a strange thing.
It is. If you think that the mind is created by the brain, it's a strange thing.
Right. So then the question is, what is consciousness?
Right. Well, that's the great question. I don't know how to answer that, but I can talk about, what does it have to do with the brain?
Okay.
Because as I said, clearly in everyday life, the brain seems to be playing a role in our consciousness.
Right.
But it clearly doesn't happen all the time. So if the brain doesn't create our thoughts, what is it good for? Why do we have these brains? Well, we're animals. We evolved in the physical world, and our brains are physical organs, and they evolved to help us survive. So what that means is they want to bring into our awareness things that help us survive in the physical world, find food and shelter and a mate and so forth, avoid predators. So to do that, it needs to filter out some things and let in other things. So for example, if your consciousness out there somewhere is communing with God and seeing deceased loved ones, that doesn't help you find food and shelter. So the brain, to be effective, has to filter all that stuff out and just let in the, quote, important stuff. Is this good to eat? Is that bad to eat? And that's the way it functions. This should not be surprising because all our senses do that. You don't hear every wavelength that's available to be heard. You just hear the short segment of a wavelength that's important to us. We don't see all the light frequencies that are available either. We just saw the visible spectrum, not the ultraviolet and the infrared, because those aren't important to us. So it makes sense that the brain would filter out the unimportant stuff and just let in the important stuff. This is not a new idea. Hippocrates wrote about this 2,000 years ago. And there's lots of evidence for the brain doing some type of filtering out of consciousness. So I don't know where it is, but it certainly doesn't seem to be in the brain. It works in connection with the brain.
So when there is emotion, anger, any of that kind of stuff, is that the mind or is that the brain? Or is it a slight combination of the two?
Well, the way we experience it, it's a combination. The pure sense, the emotion of love or hate or anger sounds like it's part of consciousness. And yet we feel it in the body. We feel our heart racing. We start to sweat. We get hot. These are all the physical sensations that go along with our expression of the emotion. And that has to involve the brain. So it's a kind of a combination of the consciousness and then the body mechanisms to express that.
So then the hardwiring that happens when we're between the years of 1 and 6, where all that exposure, we're really setting our personalities up for a lot, not our personalities, because I always say we're kind of pre-wired at the factory. With certain scenarios, if you will, talents and skills and so on that are natural to us. I will never play in the NBA. These are things that are programmed
right.
in the factory, if you will. But that kind of hardwiring of our cultural exposure, our parental exposure, our environment, is that physically being done in the brain, or is that a combination of the mind and brain?
Yeah, I think the kind of conditioning you're talking about is in the brain.
Okay.
But there's also a component of the consciousness because, clearly whether you can play in the NBA is partly determined by your genes, what you inherited physically. Now, you inherit a certain range of athletic ability, and you can increase that or decrease that by practice, but you can't exceed those limits.
Right.
But in terms of personality, whether you're a loving person, a hateful person.
Or my skill sets with math, right. Math or with right. Sciences, things like that.
Right. Well, part of the emotional stuff, part of the personality is you're hardwired for these limits. But within those limits, your experience determines where you are in that. And someone who is a mean, nasty person can become a loving, altruistic person with the right experiences. And sometimes those experiences are the ones we call spiritual, the ones that get us out of our body.
Now, with your experiences of what is a standard near-death experience? And I know there's not a standard, but like are there common traits in all of the studies that you've done over the years?
Yes.
Because I've heard of the timeline review and certain things like that. What are those kind of goalposts, if you will?
Right.
Of a standard near-death experience.
Right. Of course, everyone is different, but there are some similarities across the globe, across religions, cultures, and even going back into ancient times. We have reports from ancient Greece and Rome that sound like the NDEs we hear today. And what they include is first changes in the way your thoughts are going. Your thoughts become faster and clearer. Your perceptions get clearer. You have a sense of reviewing your entire life, often in minute detail. And you have a sense of suddenly understanding things you couldn't understand when you're in the body. There are also changes in your emotional state. Your emotions are much more intense than they ever were before. And usually, for most people, it's a very blissful, pleasant feeling. You often feel encapsulated by unconditional love. And sometimes this is personalized as an encounter with a warm, loving being of light. There are also things that we have to call paranormal, for lack of a better word, things like your usual senses, vision and hearing become much more acute than usual. You also have frank extrasensory perception, being able to be aware of things going on outside the range of your senses. There are also some people who have visions of the future in the near-death experience and a sense of being outside the physical body. And in many cases, people can actually look down and see their bodies from above and describe accurately what was going on with the body. And then in some near-death experiences, you have a sense of leaving the physical world behind and going to some other realm or dimension that where you will meet deceased loved ones or entities that seem like deities, like gods. And you may eventually come to a border or point of no return that you can't pass and still come back to life.
Is there one NDE in all of your studies that stood out to you in the sense of like, that's so unique in its way of going about things? I haven't heard that one before.
You know, there are hundreds of them, Alex. each one just blows my mind. But I can give you some examples of some things that really struck me. You know, many people have this life review where you go back and not only see, but re-experience your entire life. And for about a third of those people, they re-experience their lives not only through their own perspective, but also through the eyes of other people involved in the situation. Let me give you an example of this. A fellow I knew very well, Tom, in his 30s, he was working underneath his truck in his driveway. And it was jacked up. And actually, there was a pothole underneath, an air hole underneath, air pocket underneath his driveway, and it collapsed. And the truck came down and crushed his chest. And at that point, he had a near-death experience. He had a lot of things that were in the NDE, but one of the things that stood out to me was his life review. And he remembered many, many incidents. And one that he told me about was when he was a teenager. He was driving his truck down the street and a drunk man walked out in front of his truck. And he jammed on the brakes, almost hit the guy. He was very angry at this guy, rolled down his window and started yelling at the man. And the man, being quite intoxicated, reached his hand in the window and slapped Tom across the face. This is too much for this hot-headed teenager. So he got out of the truck and started punching the man. And ended up leaving him a bloody mass on the median strip, and then calmly got back in his truck and drove away. Well, when he had his near-death experience, he relived this very vividly, feeling the adrenaline rush and the rage and so forth, and also saw the whole thing through the eyes of the man that he beat up, feeling the guy being confused and intoxicated, feeling Tom's fists coming into his face 32 times. Now, Tom couldn't have told you it was 32 blows, but when he re-experienced it from that man's eyes, he knew there were 32 of them. He felt his nose getting bloody. He felt his teeth going through his lower lip. He felt all the embarrassment about being beaten up by a teenager. And when Tom came back to life from his near-death experience, he brought back this intense sensation that I'm just the same as that guy, that what I did to him, I did to myself. And they were all interconnected. And this gives near-death experiencers a real sense of what we call the golden rule, which is part of every religion we have. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But for near-death experiencers like Tom, they say, it's no longer for me a guideline we're supposed to follow. It's a law of nature that I experienced, that when you hurt other people, you hurt yourself as well. And when you help others, you're helping yourself as well. I've heard that again and again from near-death experiencers. And for many of them, the life review is one of the most important parts of the NDE in terms of changing their lives afterwards.
Now, you mentioned a little bit about the earliest reports of NDEs. Can you talk a little bit about the history of NDEs? Because that's something I've really never heard too much about as far as ancient Greece, because generally speaking, you know, the CPR wasn't that good back then. And they didn't have those machines that clear, like that wasn't the thing back then. So there was not as many NDEs. You had a heart attack. It pretty much was the end of it. So there wasn't a lot of that going on back then. Yeah. And I guess that's one thing that Dr. Raymond Moody said when he was on the show is like, we started tracking more of this in the last
80 years, 100 years, because we started to be able to bring people back to life because of modern medicine. Yeah. So what is the history?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, well, first let me just dispense with the illusion that we're good at it now.
Yeah, better, a little bit better.
In the hospital, where people have all its equipment available, about 25% of people who have cardiac arrests are able to be revived.
Wow.
So the vast majority are still dying on the table, in spite of having all this equipment with us. And when you're not in the hospital, chances of surviving are very low.
Right, exactly.
But we do have reports from ancient Egypt and Greece and Rome about near-death experiences. In fact, in ancient Egypt and in Greece, they had rituals to put people in a near-death condition to try to stimulate their spiritual growth. For example, the Egyptians would bury people in a coffin for several hours and then bring them back in hopes of having them have a near-death experience and then being a spiritual guide after that. But there are many reports from ancient Greece and Rome. The first one was in Plato's Republic. He talked about a soldier, Er, who was killed in the battle. And he was given a heroic funeral and put on top of a funeral pyre. And as they're about to light it, he sat up. And he told about this incredible voyage to the afterworld. Now, one thing that I want to mention is about half of people who have a near-death experience report seeing his deceased loved one.
Right.
And that's often dismissed by critics by saying, well, of course you expect to have that happen. When you die, you want to see loved ones, so you imagine seeing them. And that may explain some cases. But in a lot of cases, you see someone who you didn't know had died. And that makes it hard to explain in terms of expectation or wishful thinking. And we have an example of that going back to the first century. Pliny the Elder, the Roman historian, wrote about the case of Corfidius, who was a Roman nobleman who died. And his brother made the funeral arrangements, had the guy taken to an undertaker. And when he was on the embalming table, he suddenly sat up. He clapped his hands, which was the signal that these noblemen had for calling a servant. And they came in and he was wide awake. And he said, I've just been to visit my brother at his house. And I was there and watched him die. And he told me, after he died, he said, I want you to raise my daughter, and here's why I want you to do it. And he told me where he had his gold buried in the backyard. And the undertaker and his assistant are just staring at him like, what's going on here? And as they're sitting there, the brothers comes running in saying, my master's just died. Now, nobody knew that. And yet the person who had the near-death experience did. And I've got cases that I've heard in the last several years like this, where people encounter someone who was dead, but no one knew had died.
That's so fascinating. And the whole concept of expecting it, I mean,
yeah.
Dr. Eden Alexander was essentially an atheist.
Yes.
And he had this very detailed, intense, and he was medically pretty much considered gone. And had this, so that kind of throws that out the window. And there's a lot of atheists who like a doctor who just or scientists who just didn't believe in the afterlife having a near-death experience.
Yeah. And a lot of people who are religious and do have strong beliefs will say, my near-death experience was nothing like what I was told it was going to be like.
Right.
My church got it all wrong.
Right. Because from my studies of near-death experiences from the people I've interviewed, there isn't a heaven and hell per se. There's no one that said that, like, oh, I met the devil and there was fire and brimstone. There was none of that. It's always generally the life review, positive energy, but you do feel the negative things you do to other people.
Yeah.
Everybody crossed your path, even people who didn't cross your path that you had an impact on, you feel the good and you feel the bad during that life review, which could be, as far as time is concerned, that's my next question. How is time perceived in these near-death experiences from your studies?
That's a great question, Alex, because almost every near-death experiencer say time was not the same. that what we think of the linear time here is just an artifact of this physical world. That once you get outside this area, time either stops or ceases to exist or just is meaningless. And yet when they tell you the near-death experience, they tell it like a sequence of events. This happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And as far as I can understand, you can't have a sequence of events unless you have a passage of time like we have here. Mm. And when I ask experiences about that, they say, well, yeah, when I tell you about it here, it's a paradox. It doesn't make sense. But over there, it wasn't a paradox. It was perfectly normal. Things happened in a sequence, all at once. Past, present, future, it was all there, and yet it was also in a sequence. And I know that can't happen here in the physical world, but that's the way it was over there. So I don't know how to explain this, but there's a lot I can't explain about the near-death experience. And one of the keys, I think, is that when you ask an experiencer to tell you about what happened to them, they usually start by saying, I can't, there aren't any words for it. You can't put this into language. And then we say, great, tell me about it. So we're making them distort it by putting it into words. So how do they do that? They use metaphors. And the metaphors they use are often cultural or religious. So for example, I said, many people see this warm, loving being of light. And when you talk to someone from a Judeo-Christian culture, they may say God. But people from another culture that doesn't have a discrete God like that won't use that word. And even people here will say, and this light was God. I'm going to use that word so you'll know what I'm talking about. But this wasn't the God I was taught about in church. It was much bigger than that. So we have to take what they say with a grain of salt. So when they talk about something that seemed heavenly or hellish, it wasn't the literal place that we call heaven or hell. It's a metaphor for what they experienced.
What is your experience with dreams? Because as far as dreams are concerned, from my experience of dreams, dreams work in metaphor, and dreams have no time. Time is not a thing in a dream sequence in your mind while you're dreaming, or in your consciousness while you're dreaming. It's not like that dream took 5 minutes to go through. That dream took, there's none of that. So is there some sort of parallels between those two?
Well, they're both parallels in the sense that we're not in our usual consciousness. Now, in a dream, you do have a sequence of events. You do have some sort of time, but it's fluid. You can move back and forth through time. And we can't do that, obviously, here in our normal, everyday consciousness. Mm-hmm. Are dreams of the same quality as near-death experiences? That's interesting, because what we call dreams are really a mixture of different things. And some dreams are just like fantasies, like imaginings. Mm-hmm. But other dreams seem to have important information for you that you didn't have before.
Correct.
And whether it comes from some outside entity or from deeper parts of yourself that you didn't know about, or your quote higher self, whatever that is, you seem to be interacting with something other than your normal consciousness in those dreams. So I think some dreams have some things in common with near-death experiences, but the actual average run-of-the-mill dream that we have every night probably is not. That's probably much more like just a fantasy or a daydream or a hallucination.
Now, what are the parallels between psychedelics and near-death experiences? Because, if you study Timothy Leary and Ram Dass and those young folks back in the 60s and 70s, when they were experiencing with LSD psilocybin, thank you. The experiences they talk about seem similar to a near-death experience, but not as intense or as structured. But they feel like they kind of, if a near-death experience is a full journey, this is kind of like, I just rented the car, maybe looked around a little bit, but I really didn't go all the way.
Right. Well, many, many psychedelic trips with a variety of drugs can produce a lot of the same types of spiritual adventures that you see in a near-death experience. They also produce a lot of terrifying experiences that don't hang together the way the narrative of an NDE does. Now, one of the problems of trying to make sense out of this and say, oh, the NDE is like a trip on such and such, and that explains chemically what's going on, is that a lot of different types of psychedelic drugs that have totally different mechanisms in the brain produce the same type of experience. So for example, psilocybin works on the, it can work on the serotonin receptors, and ketamine, which is often used to produce drugs such like this, works on the NMDA receptors, and others work on dopamine receptors. So there's not some consistency with what chemical process in the brain produces these experiences. It's like all these different drugs kind of shut down the normal processing of the brain and allows consciousness to come out. So the drug is not causing the experience, it's getting the brain out of the way so you can go ahead and experience it. It opens the door to it.
And some people do that through either meditation or like the yogis, the great spiritual masters, they're able to go in and go out in their meditative practices because of their masters, essentially spiritual masters. Yeah. So this is, it's a hack, but it's not nearly as intense, which is one of the reasons why Ram Dass got tired of doing trips, because he's like, I can't stay here. I want to stay here. And then he found Maharishi, who he's like, oh, I finally found someone who's high all the time. I want to know what he's doing.
Right,
he's in that state at all times. So there's just a really interesting parallel between near-death experiences. It seems to all come back down to consciousness and getting this meat sack, a very unofficial, this meat sack out of the way, the material out of the way, so the spirit, the consciousness can be allowed, because it seems like it's weighing us down. It's very heavy on us. It's a coat that's extremely heavy. We can't really move well. And all of the things we're talking about all have in common that they release that weight and allows you to experience your true nature in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of near-death experiences will put it in those terms. They'll say it's like taking off a coat when you leave, and they don't like coming back into the body. It's unpleasant. But you're right that most religions have developed some technology for getting into this altered state, whether it's by psychedelic drugs or meditation or flagellating themselves or dancing or drumming, some way of getting your brain to quiet down and letting your consciousness to flourish.
Like a sweat lodge or something along
those lines. Yes, exactly. And there have been some attempts in recent years to try to compare accounts of near-death experiences and accounts of psychedelic drug trips. And I was actually part of the multinational team that did this. We compared, I think it was around 800 near-death experience accounts with more than 15,000 drug accounts. I mean, trying to find what drug produces the experience most like a near-death experience. And again, there were lots of different drugs that did it. It wasn't just one. But the experiences were not the same. People who have had both drug experiences and real NDEs, like Eben Alexander, will say it's not the same. And they often give the analogy of actually being in combat or watching a movie about war. That if someone asked you to describe what you saw and heard, you may use the same words, but nobody would think that watching a movie was the same experience as actually being in combat. So comparing the accounts of psychedelic drug trips and NDEs doesn't mean they're the same experience. It means we have to use the same words to describe this unusual state we had.
So it's like watching the first 15, 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan and actually storming the beach in Normandy.
Exactly.
One's really intense and the other one is ridiculously intense.
Yeah.
And I love movie analogies. So that makes all the sense in the world, because when you watch the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, even people who were at Normandy said that's the closest anyone has ever gotten to what it was like being there. But
you can have a traumatic reaction to that, to watching the movie, just as you can to being in real life. I think it's also true that with a psychedelic drug trip, you can have spiritual after effects. just as you can with a near-death experience, but it's not of the same degree.
Yeah, it absolutely. Now, culturally, that's the one thing that I've heard so many times with people who want to try to debunk this, is that, oh, you know, it's just because you intended it or something like that. But this is happening not only now from what I've learned from you today throughout history, but from culture to culture, it seems to be the same sequence of events. Again, everyone's different, but there's general markers of what a near-death experience is, regardless of culture, language, religion, any of that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Is there any, from your experience, how many different cultures did you actually study and religions and languages of people?
Yeah. Well, the quality of the research is different in all different cultures. Most of the better research has been done in the US and in England and in Europe, which is pretty much the same culture.
Pretty much.
Judeo-Christian culture. But there have been researchers in Japan and China and in India who have found the same types of experiences. There have been isolated reports of other cultures, for example, Australian Aborigines, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, that report the same types of experiences. But of course, those are just a few cases, not large studies like we have in other countries. But the metaphors people will use in different places are different, and that will affect how they describe what happens. For example, I mentioned people sometimes come across this border they can't cross and come back to life. And here in the West, we often talk about a gate or something like that, whereas in Japan, they often talk about coming to a river that they can't cross. And actually, we have that in the West, too. We have the River Jordan. You have to cross the Jordan to get to the other side. But there are analogies, like people often describe, to get from this physical realm to this other realm, you have to go through a long, dark, enclosed space. And here in the West, we usually call that a tunnel. I went through this tunnel to get to the other side. Well, in cultures that don't have a lot of tunnels, they don't use that word. They may say, I went into a cave, or I fell into a well, or some other metaphor that's appropriate to their culture. I interviewed one guy here who was a truck driver who described getting sucked into a tailpipe. And that was his metaphor for the tunnel. So the same phenomenon occurs all over the world, but they describe it in different terms.
Dr. Grayson, after all of this research, you're talking decades now that you've been doing this.
Yeah.
You've never experienced one yourself, correct?
No, that's right. I haven't.
So how has this affected your life of just constantly studying this and understand? Like, how has that affected your own personal life and your own journey through this physical time that we're here?
Well, it's made me feel differently about death and what death is. One of the things that near-death experiencers say most consistently is they're no longer afraid of dying after they've had this experience. And I'm certainly not afraid of dying, but I can't say that I ever was. I mean, when I grew up as a materialist, I thought, well, death is the end. So what's it to be afraid of? There's nothing bad after that. You just don't exist. So I wasn't afraid before. But I did have a sense when I started out this research that science was going to answer all our questions for us. And I was a little uncomfortable not having answers. And after 50 years now of studying these phenomena, that it's hard to even find the questions, let alone the answers, I'm getting comfortable with the fact that there aren't answers to everything. And that's fine, because I'm fairly convinced from what near-death experiences say that the universe is a friendly place. There's nothing to be afraid of here. The only thing we're afraid of is what we imagine.
No.
So, I can't say that I know what's going to happen after death, because I think whatever they're telling me about it is a metaphor, not the reality. But I do have a sense that whatever happened, that something happens after death, and whatever it is, it's not something to be afraid of.
In your studies, what part of reincarnation has been included? Have you heard of people dealing with past lives, looking at past lives in their life review, coming back with that kind of knowledge that helps them in this, like, you know, because obviously reincarnation has been talked about for thousands of years and in Eastern philosophies and so on. So what has there been an aspect of that in your work?
Very little. There are occasional people who will say that in their life review, it included scenes that didn't happen in this lifetime, that seemed to be from a past lifetime.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I've got a few examples of people who were actually able to corroborate the things that happened in this past lifetime. For example, one fellow remembered being shot down in an airplane during the war. And he knew some details like where it was and what the month was and so forth. And his daughter actually did some research on this and found that there was somebody who lived at that time who matched in detail everything this guy was remembering. Anita Morjani, who had a very elaborate near-death experience when she was dying with lymphoma, she experienced in her near-death experience a past lifetime with her brother, her brother in the present life, who was in her last life as well. And she said it wasn't like it was a past life. It was like an alternate life that was still going on. And this kind of relates back to the concept of what's time in this other realm. That these other lives, which we here think about as being past lives, aren't past in the near-death experience. They're like all there at the same time. So that you have all these different alternative lives you're living. And when we're here in this realm, we say, no, this is my current life. Those others must be past lives. But in the near-death experience, they're not past at all. They're still going on.
So you're talking about possible, I hate to use the term, multiverse. Are there multiple lifetimes going on at the same time, us experiencing, you know, based on reincarnation, that you experience everything, being a woman, being a man, being the oppressor, being the oppressed, being rich, being poor, you experience it all.
Yeah.
In your research, have you said that you're thinking that there might be multiple lifetimes going on at the same? So basically all the movies are playing at the same time on the screen, if you will, but you're only able to see one or experience one, possibly?
I think that's when we're looking at it, Alex, but that's the way we look at it here in our consciousness here.
Right.
But they usually say that when you're in the other realm, there's no separation. There's no multiple universes. It's all one. Everything's all one. So it's all happening at the same time in different places, in different eras, all at the same time.
Fascinating. This is why this is such a fact. I mean, no wonder you spent 50 years going down this road. This is, I mean, it's just endless. It's just endless stories, endless discovery. Can you discuss a little bit about out-of-body experiences and what happens? Just your experiences with out-of-body experiences. And what is an out-of-body experience for people who don't know?
Yeah. Well, there are different ways of defining it, but basically it's a sense of leaving the physical body. And then when I first started out, I thought that was ridiculous. I am my body. How can you leave it? You know? But I've heard enough accounts of people who have left their bodies. One definition of it is just sort of losing track of the body and feeling like you're outside it. We tend to use a more restricted definition where you have to be able to look down and see your physical body from some other perspective. So you really know that you're not in it because you're seeing it from somewhere else. And we see that in a lot of near-death experiences, maybe 40, 50% of them. In many of these cases, they don't come back with information that we can really corroborate that's unusual. For example, they may say, oh yeah, the doctor was there wearing green scrubs. Of course, you'd expect that. But many times they report things that are very unexpected. Let me give you an example of that. One fellow I knew was a 55-year-old truck driver who had crushing chest pain. So he was rushed to the hospital. And in the emergency room, they discovered he had four vessels going to his heart that were being clogged. So they rushed him to the operating room for an emergency quadruple bypass surgery.
Jesus.
And in that operation, he tells me, he left his body and rose up above it. And he looked down and saw his surgeon flapping his arms like he was trying to fly. Now, at this point, when he told me this, I've been a doctor for about 30 years then. I'd never seen or heard anything so ridiculous in my life. You don't see doctors on TV shows doing that.
Correct.
So I assumed he was hallucinating because of the anesthesia or something like that. But he insisted it was true. And so with his permission, actually with his insistence, I talked to his surgeon. And a surgeon said, well, yes, I did do that. I developed this habit. I've never seen anyone else do it. I let my assistants start the procedure while I get my sterile gown and gloves on. And then I walk into the operating room and watch them. And I don't want to risk touching anything that's not sterile with my hands. So I put them on my chest where I know they won't touch anything. And then when I want to point things out to my assistants, I can't use my fingers. So I use my elbows. And he demonstrated that just the way the patient did. Now, there's no way the patient could have known about that.
Wow.
He says, I saw it. That's how I know about it. And I've got case after case after case of people seeing unexpected things, such as an operating room nurse having mismatched shoelaces, this type of thing. You wouldn't expect that to happen. And yet they see these things and they report them. And then doctors and nurses can corroborate, yes, that really was true.
Can you discuss a little bit about pre-life experiences? I know you've dabbled in that area as well.
Yeah. I'm not really an expert on this area. I don't really know what to make of it. There are people who have studied pre-life memories. It's hard to corroborate that type of thing. I will say that some of my colleagues at the University of Virginia study reincarnation, and they study young children, age 2, 3, 4, 5, who talk spontaneously about their past lives. And occasionally, one of these kids will talk about the time period when they were in the womb. And they talk about things usually that can't be corroborated, but sometimes they can. And they will talk about, say, having a twin that didn't make it out of the womb, and it turns out to be true. Or they will talk about some conversation they heard. Now, how can a fetus in the womb hear a conversation? But the kid will report something, and the parents will confirm, well, yeah, we did have that argument when he was 8 months old, in 8 months into the womb. And I don't know what to make of that. Is the child really remembering something that happened back then? Or are they somehow getting this information telepathically from the parents? I don't know what the answer is. I think most of the research that they've done at University of Virginia about reincarnation suggests that there was a past life this person lived, but it doesn't fit anyone's definition of what reincarnation is usually like. For example, we'll sometimes have more than one child living at the same time who report remembering the same past life. Now, that doesn't fit most people's definition of reincarnation. Or we'll have somebody who remembers details of two lives that lived at the same time in the past. So it's not clear-cut what's going on here. There's something going on beyond our normal consciousness. But what it is, our usual understanding of reincarnation is much too simple.
Interesting. So it's, my head's starting to hurt now. I'm barely wrapped around the basic concepts that we've been talking about now, let alone wait a minute, it could be two lives at the exact same time on the same planet. Yeah. But wasn't there some experiences of some of these children that they would say stuff and then they would actually do research to corroborate what they're saying? I lived at this house, at this place, and this thing. Yes. And it came to be true. And there's just no way in hell that they would know this information.
Yeah. They've studied more than 2,000 kids at University of Virginia, and about 1,000 of them, they've been able to identify the person that child claims to have been in the past life. Wow. And find that the person has information. Sometimes they will actually take the child to the other city where the person lived in the past life. And the child will take around and identify things and talk about, well, that house didn't used to have a porch on it and so forth. And they'll identify people and places. And they will not only have the information, but show the appropriate emotions towards the people that they knew in the past life.
That's just... No wonder you've been doing this for 50 years, Doc. I mean, it just keeps going and going and going. Can you just discuss a little bit about the transformative power of an NDE to people who experience them. They go in one way, they come out the other at the other end.
Yeah. Well, I'm a psychiatrist. I make my living trying to help people make changes in their lives. And for that reason, this is the most important aspect to me of a near-death experience. It's not the experience itself, as mind-blowing as that is, but it's how it changes people. And it changes them dramatically forever. I've talked to people in the 80s and 90s who had the experience as teenagers, and it's like it happened yesterday. They've never gone back to the way they were before. And the most common thing you hear is that they are no longer afraid of death and dying. Now, when I first heard that, as a psychiatrist, I was worried if we tell people about this, that death is not something to be afraid of, that's going to make people suicidal, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I did some research, and I interviewed people who were admitted to my hospital after a suicide attempt. And I compared those who had a near-death experience as a result of that suicide attempt and those who didn't. And the ones who had a near-death experience were much less suicidal afterwards than people who didn't have an NDE. And that seemed counterintuitive to me because they're no longer afraid of dying. So I asked them, "What? Explain that to me." And they said things like, "I still have the same problems I had before, but now I see a meaning and purpose in everything that happens. And I realize my problems aren't something to be run away from, but things I need to learn from and grow from." And they also say that if you're not afraid of dying, then you're also not afraid of living. You're not afraid of taking risks because you know nothing bad can happen. So I die, that's great. So you tend to enjoy life much more. You jump in with both feet, live it to the fullest, and tend to live in the present more. So people have very dramatic changes in attitudes after a near-death experience. I should say that this is true of a near-death experience, not of a close brush with death without an NDE. You know, people who almost lose their lives, usually they value life much more. But if you haven't had an NDE, you tend to be much more cautious, much more afraid of losing this life, and you take fewer risks. Whereas near-death experiencers are not fearful anymore, and they are more risk-taking. This also affects their behavior. They tend to become much more spiritual. They say, I'm not more religious. I don't follow any particular dogma, but I'm much more spiritual. And what they mean by that is they become much more compassionate and much more feeling connected to other people, not only to other people, but to animals, to plants, to the universe. They feel a part of something greater than themselves. And I've heard this not only from people who were religious beforehand, but people who were atheists beforehand, people who were agnostics beforehand. They come away with a sense of being part of some spiritual realm, spiritual universe that they weren't aware of before. And this changes their behavior as well. They become much more altruistic, much more caring. They tend to volunteer more. They tend to live more simply. They tend to care less about the physical world, which means not only material possessions, but power, prestige, fame, competition. These things don't make sense to them anymore. I've talked to many people who describe career changes after an NDE. For example, people who were in careers that involved violence, police officers, military officers, who felt they couldn't shoot somebody anymore. And then they end up retraining for some other career. And they often end up going into a helping career, like healthcare or teaching or social work or clergy. I've also talked to people who are cutthroat businessmen who came back saying, it doesn't make any sense to get ahead at someone else's expense because I'm connected to them. We're the same thing. So I don't want to hurt them. And they either change the way they do their business or they leave business entirely. And again, go to some other career. So it changes not only their attitudes and their beliefs, but also their behavior. That's not all good. Sometimes people's lives are built around things that they no longer care about. And I've seen marriages break up because of this. Of course, careers do, and people have to change their entire lifestyle. And that can be quite stressful, not only for the individual, but for their family as well.
So what I find fascinating about you, Doc, is that you the way you talk about NDEs is very, and I don't mean this as an insult, clinical, but in a great way. There is, because I've spoken to NDEers, and there's a lot of times emotion and
yeah,
and there's this vibe and this energy about them, and they're just so passionate. But you are passionate in a very different way. You're passionate about the exploration of the subject in a very cool-headed way. And I think that's what's wonderful about your approach to it, is that I'm a scientist. I'm looking at it that way. I'm getting the benefits of the spirituality aspects of it. You can't be exposed to this much and not be affected somehow. But yet the way you speak of it is just very, as a matter of fact, like one plus one is two. I've studied one plus ones and that equal two. So it's wonderful and refreshing the way you approach it.
Yeah. Well, you know, someone like Evan Alexander, who I know quite well, started out as a clinician. He was a doctor and a scientist, as I did. But once he had his experience, he came back with a certainty, a knowing.
Right.
And that changes his entire life. And I don't have that. I don't have that certainty. So I'm still in the framework of the clinician, trying to help people who have this experience and trying to understand it as a scientist. You know, I think saying one and one is two is a good model. And yet that's one and one makes two in this particular framework. Right. In some other framework, it may not.
There's no one or two.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, our logic comes from Aristotle. Mm-hmm. And things are either black or white. They can't be both. They can't be neither. It's got to be black or white. But Nagarjuna in India 500 years ago came up with a fourfold type of logic. Things can be black, or they can be white, or they can be black and white, or they can be neither. And that's a very different way of looking at the world. So our logic and our mathematics is just one way of making sense of the world, but it's not the only way.
And from your experience, you're no longer fear. You have no fear of death.
I say that, but I have bad moments too.
You're just like, maybe I don't want to try. I don't want to test the waters.
Well, you know, I'm a scientist. And scientists should know that everything we know is tentative. You know, we look back on what scientists thought 200 years ago and we laugh at how naive they were. Yeah. So how can you not think that scientists 200 years from now aren't going to laugh at what we think?
Oh, absolutely.
So you can't take what we think seriously. So, you know, I think this is the way things look to me. It looks to me as if the evidence says there is something after death and it's not something to be scared of. And yet, I know as a scientist, I could be misreading the information. The data could be misinterpreted. Maybe I'm not looking at it right. Maybe there's new data coming down in 50 years from now that are going to contradict this. So I can't be sure of any of this stuff.
I mean, quantum mechanics would have been laughed at 100 years ago.
Yes, and it was.
And it was. This quantum mechanics would have been laughed at, and quantum physics, all of that is, it's... And I've talked to multiple scientists and PhDs about this, that I find that science is in a way starting to catch up with what spirituality has been talking about for thousands of years, these concepts of energy, and that we are all energy. And like, if you go down so far into our DNA, into our cell structure, there's nothing, literally nothing, because our scopes are our microscopes are so powerful now that we're just, so there's like, why are we solid then? If there's nothing there, then why are we solid? Then you start reading the old ancient texts of yogis and like, oh yeah, yogis can go through walls and can be two places at the same time. And these kind of stories, you're just like, wow. So I always tell people, like, no matter what era and time man is in, it thinks it knows everything.
Right.
Just the nature of the ego, essentially.
Yeah. We should be able to step back and say, now we're really fooling ourselves.
Exactly. Now, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions I ask all of my guests. What is your mission in this life?
Well, I think it's to help people. But you know, that's the mission I give myself. If I have a mission that was given to me by somebody else, I'm not aware of it. I think, you know, some near-death experiences tell me that we came to this life with a contract that we agreed to before we came here. And I can say, I understand what you're saying. I can't relate it to my life. I don't feel that. I feel like I act as if I'm in control of what I'm doing. I choose to be a doctor, a healer, a helper. I may be wrong. I may have no say in this at all. It may have been determined before my birth, but it feels to me as if I'm doing it. So I think my mission is to help.
And what is the ultimate purpose of life?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Again, I have to go back to what the near-death experiences tell me, because in my experience, the purpose of life, I can say intellectually, is to survive and to have children survive after you. But in my experience, not as a scientist, but as a person, what gives the most meaning to life is personal relationships, family, close friends. If you ask near-death experiencers, they usually say it's to love. That we came here to learn how to love. And I say, well, wait a minute, you're saying that the other world is full of love. Why do you need to come back here for it? You say, because here we have conflict. You don't have it over there. You need to learn to love in spite of the conflict. And that's why we came to the earth.
Now, where can people find out more about you and your book and the work that you're doing, sir?
The best place to start is probably my website, which is www.brucegrayson, that's BRUCEGREYSON.com. It's got information about the book, how to order it. It's been out for about a year in hardback. It just came out in paperback this month in the US and in the UK. And it also has resources there to other sources of information, links to other sites and so forth.
Dr. Grayson, I really do appreciate the work that you've been doing all these years. And I appreciate you writing the book and helping people just guide them a little bit on what your experiences are and your studies are of what happens when we pass on. And hopefully that helps us live a little bit better every day. So I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
I hope this episode has opened your mind a little bit to what is in the afterlife, and hopefully it helps you understand a little bit more about how you can live a more fulfilling life. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get a copy of his best-selling book, After, just head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/056. And if you've only been listening to this over podcast and you want to watch these amazing conversations, please subscribe to our YouTube channel at nextlevelsoul.com/YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, trust the journey. It is here to teach you. I'll talk to you soon.